Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
We kick things off this morning with Torsten Slok. He's here in our Bloomberg 1130 studios. He's the chief international economist at Deutsche Bank. Great to have you with us. And let's start with this election in Japan. Let me get your thoughts on sort of how it panned out, better than I think the snap election in the UK a few months ago did for the person who called it. What does it mean for the economy, looking like, as though it seems like Shinzo Abe is going to continue with another term as prime minister?
Yeah, I mean, as usual, investors want a continuation of current policies. In some cases, of course, they want change. But in this case, the mandate seems to be stronger for Abenomics to just continue pushing on, in particular, the third era of doing structural reform, of helping liberalizing labor markets, liberalizing product markets, get the economy more competitive. So I think the first point is that, this will continue current policies, and I think that will probably be good news for the market. The second thing that's also critical is that in April, Kuroda's term runs out. So another issue, of course, that's been discussed a lot is, I've seen both with clients here and abroad, we debate, well, will Kuroda continue? And it looks like this will probably now be a continuation, and therefore, in some sense, also a continuation of the policies that have been going on with QQE.
We focus there on who's going to be leading that central bank. The focus here in the U.S. is squarely on that as well. How do you begin to forecast what it would mean to have a John Taylor Fed or a Kevin Warsh Fed or any other permutation of Federal Reserve? How much does that matter at this point in your estimation? Who's leading the Fed?
I think it's extremely important. Uh-huh. The problem is that I just don't have a model where I, on the left-hand side, have the Fed chair, because I don't know what to put on the right-hand side and predict that. So in other words, all joking aside, I just think that it is a very important issue, but the market has been grappling with how to quantify that risk. If it is one candidate, is that candidate going to follow through on what they have promised and said earlier? Are those candidates going to change their minds? Are those candidates going to listen mainly to what Trump is saying? A lot of things that just go into making this a really difficult thing for markets to deal with, because it's just so unquantifiable in so many dimensions. That doesn't mean that markets don't really care too much, but this story has in some sense been battling with the short sellers of all. Volatility, despite this uncertainty, volatility remains incredibly low. Not only VIX, but also swaption vol or fixed income vol, both in credit and in rates, remains incredibly low, despite that we just don't know what the outcome is at this front. And this is just not something people have been willing to bet vol high on, because you just don't really know how to quantify the different risks on this trade.
Torsten, you've written most recently about normalization of volatility. And I wonder, what's going to catalyze that? What does it mean? And what's going to be the catalyst that brings it about?
Yeah, so this is a really important question in my mind. I mean, the whole reason why equities are doing well, the whole reason why credit is doing well, the whole reason why rates remain so low is because we just don't yet have any signs of inflation. If you on your Bloomberg screen type ECFC Go, you will see that the expectation to inflation over the next 2 years is that inflation, here we're talking about core PCE inflation, which is what the Fed is looking at, is going to remain low essentially up to the second quarter of next year. So in other words, this is saying that the music is still playing, and therefore if the first domino brick we're waiting for to topple here is inflation, and if we will only see that in consensus expectations in the second quarter of next year, then I think that equities will continue to do well, credit spreads will do well, and rates are probably not going to go up much, and the Fed is probably going to be still more on the relatively dovish side, at least in terms of what they're saying.
Good morning, everyone. David Gura and Tom Keene. Getting your Monday started. It was a sports weekend.
Yes.
Yankees down in flames.
True.
Jets down in flames.
Giants.
Giants down in
flames. Trifecta.
It was sort of a New York in flames kind of weekend. Torsten Slok with us. Well, to that point, how critical is the hard data to the December 1st, the December FOMC meeting? They've got a November 1st meeting, which I'm told is a non-event. Then they have December 13th. Am I right, Torsten? There's no data showing inflation yet?
At that time, our expectation is, the Fed's own expectation is, and the consensus expectation is, yes, as you say, absolutely correct, there is not an expectation of inflation at that time. That's why some FOMC members, Evans, Brainard, Bullard, Kashkari, have come out and said, hey, wait a minute, why are we actually going to hike rates in December if there's really not a whiff of inflation at the time?
What's critical with your great observation is each of those people put their pants on differently. Kashkari's different than Bullard, et cetera. Evans is a grizzled Carnegie Mellon data guy. He's like Larry Myers. He wants to see the data, right?
Absolutely. It's show me the money. When the Godot stands in the door, then I will know it. And if I don't, then I will have to wait a little bit longer. And I think for them, it's really an issue. And Evans has been saying that very clearly. Why should we hike if there is no signs of inflation?
David, the problem with dealing with Torsten Slack and these Europeans is I've got to know about Godot. Can you make a note? Colin of the Twins, can you get me the cliff notes on waiting for Godot? You know, I gotta like get... You know, come on, let's do math. Waiting for Godot. Let me look it up in Wikipedia.
There you go. While you continue. Do that, let's look ahead to Thursday here, the East Sweet Governing Council meeting on Thursday. What are you looking for out of that meeting this week? What do you expect the commentary to be like surrounding it?
So the bottom line on that is the ECB going to give an end date to their QE? They have done QE now for the last few years. They have an easy policy for the last 5-6 years. And if they have had easy and negative interest rates, and if they're going to put an end date to this, the worry you can have is that bonds that are trading on the day after the end date to their purchases could start to move. And most importantly, of course, the fear in the marketplace is that if the ECB is no longer buying government bonds in the periphery, Italy, other countries, of course, then the fear is that who will then be buying it the day after? So that's why a significant focus of attention here for the ECB meeting on Thursday is, will they provide an end date to the purchases or will they keep it open?
And what's your thinking on that? You think it's likely to?
So, I mean, we're coming down on the side of saying that they're likely to give 9 months going into September there for next year, but obviously this is a very difficult call, but it does become extremely important how they phase out, and it tells you, because the magnitude of QE that they have done, as Tom and I just spoke on TV, the magnitude of what they have done is just so much bigger. They have bought 7 times issuance in the last few years, and this significant firepower that has been brought to the market by the ECB, once that reverses, is therefore at risk also of having significant implications for not only, of course, rates, but most importantly, all the assets that people were buying, credit and equities included.
Then what does it mean that the Swiss National Banks, you know, not with the challenges of the ECB, am I correct? They own like X amount of Apple shares. They own equities.
So they own equities.
Explain that. Why does a central bank own an equity portfolio?
So as you know, the Japanese also have been buying ETFs, but the answer here is that the Swiss came to the conclusion that it was difficult probably to buy Swiss companies. So therefore, they are buying non-Swiss companies, and now they end up holding significant amounts of non-Swiss companies. Absolutely.
Quickly here, let me ask you about the ramifications of what we're seeing play out in northern Spain. The tension persists there between those in Catalonia and the Spanish government. How do you see that affecting Europe as a whole?
So obviously, the political landscape in Europe has been shifting in different ways, and it always fluctuates a bit back and forth. It's a bit of a tango in many different ways. But I still think that at the end of the day, that the ECB looks at that mainly from a perspective of how has it impacted markets from up to now? And the answer is not that much. And what is the impact likely going to be in the future? And the conclusion probably could also be not that much. Then they are probably a sigh of relief in Frankfurt at the moment that at least so far it seems manageable from a monetary policy perspective.
Torsten Slack, thank you so much. David, I'm up to speed now. Thomas A. Becket, 1952, waiting for Godot. You know, I've got to be honest.
Around the holidays, we could do a dramatic reading.
Do I need to, I need to get through this play, right?
Yeah, well.
Did you do, let me tell you, you did this in what, sixth grade?
Maybe high school. I don't know. It's been a while. But share the cliff notes with me when you're done.
You know the phrase, Bucky freaking Dent?
No.
To be careful here on radio with my
language. Very good, yeah.
There's now a new phrase, Justin freaking Verlander.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Michael Barr, did you see this?
Yes, I did.
Was it fun? It was fun.
Well, I thought the Yankees would make it in Game 7. Game 6, no, because Verlander was great.
To all of you worldwide, it was a fun weekend in New York, even though it went down in flames. It was good to see.
Let's get out of John Vale. He joins us now in our Bloomberg 1130 studios. We've called on him from time to time here to talk about Japan. from a political perspective, economic perspective. He is a chief global strategist at Nikko Asset Management. Joins us here, as I said, in our Bloomberg 1130 studios in New York. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, David.
Tom mentioned the landslideness of the election that we saw over the weekend. Help us understand the economic import of this. As Torsten Slok of Deutsche Bank was saying at the top of the show, the governor of the Bank of Japan sees his tenure coming to a close, perhaps here in a few months at time. Does this change that necessarily, having this victory that we saw over the weekend?
I think it changes things in the intermediate term because I think the success of this election does mean a mandate for him to raise the VAT, and that will start to affect the economy even at the end of next year as people sort of pre-buy their goods before the VAT hike, which always happens in Japan. So that will be a pretty major fiscal effect. As for monetary policy, I think Kuroda was pretty much assumed to stay on even before this election. But if the election had been a disaster, then perhaps Kuroda would not have stayed. It's not 100% that he will stay. He's old. He's 72. But I think he's pretty game to see his effort through and reach the inflation target.
You mentioned that VAT hike. Explain sort of what that is, what he's proposed, and how that factored into calling the snap election.
Well, the Ministry of Finance has been pushing for a sales tax increase, essentially, for ages. And they originally wanted it to be 20%, so European levels, by the year 2020, the Olympics. But Abe has delayed over the years in terms of raising it. He raised it once, and it had a huge shock effect on the economy in 2014. And he's very reluctant to do it again. But this time he's couched it quite well, and it was part of his platform, basically, to raise the VAT and to spend the money on education and training.
I mean, just to give people an idea, the budget balance of Japan is 5.67% of GDP. Does that sound about right, John?
Yes.
5.7%. The United States is 3.7%. Japan's deficit to GDP ratio is 53% larger than the United States. Their trilemma is different than ours. Their degrees of freedom of ability to move is way different than our institutions, isn't it?
In a way, because their interest rates are sort of locked at a low level, first of all, because of BOJ policy, but just because of this persistent pessimism about their economy, their interest rates always remain quite low. So it almost seems it's a dangerous supposition, but no matter the budget deficit, it was at 10% of GDP, 7 years ago. Yeah. Their interest rates don't seem to worry too much about the deficit.
Why is that?
Well, they're pessimistic about their own economy, to be honest. A lot of the institutional investors are quite happy to get 1% or 2% because they don't think that if it ever goes that high, I mean, to get to 2% would be quite something. But they're just not really that worried. They're actually more worried about the rest of the world than they are the Japanese.
With a landslide election, to borrow a phrase from President Reagan, is it mourning in Japan?
I'm sorry, what way mourning?
I don't know. Just psychologically, is it mourning in Japan?
I think
Gary Schilling keeps talking about good deflation in Japan. Is it?
Well, I think low inflation is good for Japan. But I would say that there's a pretty good chance that things could get rather ebullient there in the markets. Because if there's global reflation, then you'll have interest rates probably rising in the States. And if that happens, then the yen tends to weaken. If the yen tends to weaken, the stock market tends to go up. And with the longest-serving prime minister there, political stability, I mean, there'll be a hiccup, obviously, with this VAT hike at the end of next year when they start planning it. It won't happen until October of 2019, right before the Olympics. But I think there could be a period of, a fresh new start sort of in the market.
I mean, in yen terms, David Gura, the Japanese market's up 26% in the last 12 months. That's a terrible return.
John, what does the opposition look like in Japan today? We were talking a few weeks back about Governor Koike of Tokyo, who mounted an opposition campaign here, started a party of her own, the Party of Hope, and I think they secured just under 50 seats in the lower house. What do we learn about the opposition from her running, and do you suspect she's going to play a prominent role here going forward? Is this her early debut, and do you think we're going to see more of her?
Yeah, she's not happy, nor is her party happy about their result. And it was, and as we mentioned the last time, he timed the result, the election quite
shrewdly.
Shrewdly is a good word, yeah. She was not ready. She was expecting the election probably to happen in the spring. And yes, she made a few mistakes during the election, and so her party really underperformed quite badly.
Well, David, something not in the news today, but worth a number of our listeners have sent this in, is Mr. Macron, in touch with the common man, has acquired a dog named Nemo.
Aha.
To put things in perspective, the house that the president of France lives in makes the White House look like, you know, a shack, even with the upgrades Mr. Trump has done. Yes. So they're in the Golden Room, La Salle Dorée.
Named for the gold.
Yeah, which goes back to, like, you know, I don't know, before Napoleon, I'm guessing. And seriously, the presidents have been in since 1848. Nemo enjoyed the fireplace during the meeting, I guess.
Yes, it went a little too long.
Yes, the meeting went
too
long.
Needed to be let out onto those sizable gardens.
Yes, did not have a presidential walk, but enjoyed the fireplace. Surveillance, of course, doing research with Kevin Cirilli. On the Oval Office, which has a screen across the fireplace.
Yes, the Prime Minister is saying to one of his aides, "You've sparked a totally unusual behavior in my dog." You're going to tweet this out? I won't tweet this out.
I know, I can't go there.
Do your own.
We'll just say mon Dieu and move on from there. With us, and these, of course, go to Cultural Touches, is John Vail as we look at the Japanese election. It's a good segue. There's no question about that.
From a dog to John.
From the cultural shift in Japan, and this goes back to the Ruth Benedict in other great books of World War II and out of it. First of all, the Constitution of Japan now is essentially the Constitution that MacArthur dictated. Is that a true statement?
Yes, I think he... They didn't write it exactly, but they vetted it very carefully.
And there's been a lot of study on that. They want to change the Constitution. What's the hint, the tinge that they want to go towards?
Their Constitution says they will have no army, basically. And they already have an army. And basically, Abe, with, I think, U.S. support, wants to be able to say, yes, we have an army. That's basically it.
To just get away from the first step of the agony of the middle 20th century.
He feels that Japanese today, you know, who grew up, the generations that grew up after the war, who bear no responsibility for the war, should not have to have this hanging over their head, that they should be more normal nation and have an army just like any other
nation.
And
they're the unique exception to this. I mean, not that we're running a history lesson here, but I can't think of another country out of any given war. I mean, we didn't say to the French after Napoleon, you can't have an army, I believe.
Yes, that's correct. I think maybe a few small countries don't have armies like Costa Rica or something like that. But yes, Japan is quite unique in that. But they have huge military, and it's one of the largest in the world.
David, does Brooklyn have an army?
No, not yet. We'll see if the Constitutional Convention delivers one in a few times. John, let me ask you about the relationship between Japan and the U.S. Economically and politically, sort of overlaying what we were just talking about. You have a president here in this country who is keen to see Japan take on a bigger role, perhaps out of necessity here as North Korea continues to test missiles and rockets and the like. But I wonder sort of about the strength of the economic relationship between the two countries and what you think we're going to see when the president of the United States goes to Japan here in a few weeks' time on his fairly long trip to Asia. What do you think the conversation is going to center on while he's there?
The relationship is quite good at this stage, even though Japan does run a very large trade surplus with the U.S. It's not as large as it used to be. And, of course, they've shifted a lot of production here already, especially automobiles. But I'm sure President Trump would like more of that to happen. He'd like more production to be shifted to the United States, especially into the Rust Belt, and to form better partnerships on high technology projects like the plant in Wisconsin, which is with a Taiwanese company, but it's allied with Sharp, one of the biggest consumer electronics companies in Japan, to produce LCDs. So I think he would like a lot more of that sort of investment.
And Tom, I know they are going to play golf when President Trump visits there. That was your follow-up, I'm sure, was whether there'd be a Trump golf game.
I mean, what is the relationship now of Japan with China and North Korea? We talked earlier this morning about this? I mean, this was not a foreign policy election, was it?
It was a bit. I mean, I think the fact that North Korea has been so threatening has helped Abe in many ways, because he is a bit of a hawk on defense issues, and that Japan should be ready to deal with threats like this. And so that actually helped him quite a bit. The relationship with China is warming really quite rapidly, actually, in the last 3 to 6 months.
Why is that?
I think it maybe is more from China's perspective than it is Japan's, but Japanese officials have been attending Chinese events in Japan. They're talking about having bilateral summits in each other's countries. The economic relations have always been very strong, with a few hiccups from time to time. But essentially, they need each other quite a lot, and they're finding a lot of common ground.
Is Tokyo ever present? I mean, it's a gazillion people. I don't know, was it 20 million or something?
It is right.
Mm-hmm. Something along that line. Is it the same Tokyo as 10 years ago? I mean, forget about, you know, the history of the 1923 earthquake and all that. Is it the same Tokyo as 10 years ago? Is it ever moving forward, or is there some radical shift when you go there?
No, I think it's basically the same as it was 10 years ago. I mean, there's still some underlying tensions with China, and these things go up and they go down. It depends on whether they have some island issue or not. But essentially, they've had a very strong relationship with China economically for a long time. And no, I don't sense any major new wave of anti-Chinese behavior in Japan. Yeah. In fact, quite the opposite. The people aren't electing Abe to be a warmonger at all. And they don't want a bad relationship with China. But there still are always some underlying currents.
On the issue of trade policy, of course, the U.S. withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. How has trade policy in Japan adjusted as a result of that? This was a country that was banking on the ratification of that deal. Are we seeing it move ahead with the TPP minus the U.S.? So what direction is its trade policy
going
in?
They're trying to push the TPP for ex-U.S. and maybe hoping that eventually, with a few tweaks, that the U.S. will come back in.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't think that will happen with Trump. He's just not interested in multilateral. Yeah. So, but they are working on they're trying to convince Japan to do an FTA with the U.S.
And, well, it's a free trade agreement.
Yes.
Even I got that. Yeah.
Which Japan's a bit reluctant, I think, because they're still trying with this TPP thing. Mm-hmm. But that could well happen, because that's certainly what Trump's interest is. Yeah.
John Vail, thank you so much. Great briefing. Nico Asset Management with us this morning. I love that. We try to go beyond the economics and the numbers and all that. We do that, of course, but interesting discussions there, really through the morning on Asia. Diana Choleva of Enodo as well, and the higher Chinese inflation that she sees coming. It has been too long to speak with Lupin Raman of PIMCO on emerging markets. She is just exquisite at tearing apart those trends. To go take a baseball phrase, Lupin, of 1 through 9 innings, which inning are we in the resurgence of emerging markets?
Hi, Tom. Good to be back. I would say that we're probably looking at a mature phase of the cycle, so looking at 6 to 7, mm-hmm. Part of the cycle here. We've really seen very strong growth, very strong macro fundamentals of the last 4 quarters. This is playing out in terms of strong growth and being reflected in relatively low inflation. And what that's resulted in is significant inflows coming back into emerging markets.
Right.
But I fear that valuations are getting somewhat stretched, and the basis for future investment seems to be continued inflows, which is significantly dependent on the global backdrop.
The distinction then is, do you go to other emerging markets that are less frothy, or do you shift back to the developed world? That's always a great debate. How say you?
I think that the search really has to go for finding new sources of alpha. So those emerging markets where you're still seeing mispricing in terms mm-hmm. of the credit and local rate risk, and where investors either have a very different view to what the market is pricing in. The reason being, if you're looking at investment grade and high yield spreads in the US and Europe, they're incredibly tight. So the scope for rotating back into developed markets is relatively limited at the moment.
How cyclical an issue is this? Here in the U.S., we hear often from the chair of the Fed, among others, that we're seeing inflation as a transitory thing. When you look at disinflation globally, is it a secular phenomenon? Is it something that you see as cyclical? How do you process what we're seeing in emerging markets around the world?
Well, for emerging markets, my sense is that this is much more of a cyclical phenomena rather than a structural phenomena. When you break down headline inflation into components that are core-focused versus energy, fuel, and food, you see that the biggest deceleration has really come from food and energy prices, and a big component of that is base effects. Core inflation, which is determined by much more structural components of the economy, really hasn't come down that significantly, or at least not lower than the historical average that we've seen. So I suspect that after we've gone through this cycle of disinflation, we should see emerging market inflation actually creep back to the averages that we had pre-2015.
Which is playing a more outsized role here in emerging markets? Is it politics, political upheaval, or is it central banking? What's in the vanguard position?
I would say that it really is a combination. I think for the beta investor in emerging markets, central banks, and particularly global central banks, and what they are doing in terms of withdrawal of balance sheet that has previously been extended is going to be incredibly important. However, politics is now the source of alpha within EM, getting the political terms
right.
Correct. So we've just seen very strong results in the Argentine midterms, where the incumbent party has done exceptionally well, and we believe that this is a continuation of the Argentine alpha story. In Brazil, we have elections coming up next year, and that will be a complete sea change in terms of what we may have seen previously with the PT government. We also have the ANC in South Africa debating whether they should have a different leadership, and this will change the course of that party and South Africa for the next decade.
The easy question is, you go long South Africa, but far more fractious, how does PIMCO play Turkey? I mean, that's not like a single decision like an Argentinian election. What does Lupin Rahman do with something as complex as Turkey?
I think Turkey is one of those economies and political situations where really you have to invest from the short side. And that means that structurally, we believe Turkey is going to be negative in terms of a secular credit decline negatively. There are hardly any reforms that are occurring. And the bastion of Turkey's macro, which was the fiscal anchor, is slowly slipping. Monetary policy has always been relatively heterodox in Turkey versus other emerging markets. So we have a very negative secular view on Turkey, but the market is extremely volatile. And so the way we invest in Turkey is to really be slightly underweight and then basically buy when we see significant overshoot in the lira.
Well, we'll come back and talk more about this, but let me just ask you a broad question about trade policy as the U.S. president prepares to go to Asia. How front of center is that issue going to be as he talks to counterparts in China, in Japan, in South Korea? Is there still too much uncertainty in your estimation about trade policy as driven by the U.S.?
Yes, I think that's one of the key uncertainties that we have in terms of global policy after central banks and discussions that Trump may have with both China, the South Asian bloc, as well as NAFTA, is extremely important in driving both risk sentiment and global growth sentiment. The reason being, emerging markets tend to be a beta and have been a beta on U.S. growth for the last couple of decades. And if there is a signal that the U.S. is retrenching in terms of both its current account and its source of external growth, then emerging markets will feel both a fundamental impact as well as a market impact in terms of risk off.
Let's come back. Lupin Rahman with us with PIMCO. Just lovely ever with us, given the focus to some of the double-digit returns, huge returns, I should say, in emerging markets. We'll review those here in a moment. Continue this discussion. Lupin Raman with us with PIMCO. And, you know, Lupin, I look at 12-month return based in U.S. dollars, and there's just some remarkable emerging market performance. Is it a melt-up in emerging market values?
I think that basically what we're seeing is structural investors, institutional investors, recognizing that emerging markets have a very long-term story. I think that story had been derailed somewhat in the last couple of years, given the oil price shock, some of the politics that we've seen in EM, particularly in Brazil and Russia. But now we're seeing the re-emergence of those investors coming back to the asset class, which is extremely favorable. What we're seeing really now is the pull factor of EM. All the positive factors that we've been talking about for many years, the low debt, the fact that you have much higher growth rates, you have regime changes that are becoming much more market-oriented, all of those factors are pulling investors in. At the same time, we're actually seeing relative value across emerging markets really being able to differentiate between themselves. And so investors are looking for those turnaround alpha opportunities in EM rather than being indiscriminate buyers of EM, as they were perhaps a few years ago.
Lupin, what role is the dollar playing in the emerging market story right now?
It's very important, particularly in the local rate side. What we expect to see is the dollar moving more or less sideways. There has been some volatility as we've seen Fed rate hikes being priced in and priced out, depending on what markets expect on the fiscal front in the U.S. Mm-hmm. But in general, this view that the dollar will not have a significant appreciation secular trend from here means that emerging market currencies, particularly those high carry currencies, are looking relatively attractive.
We're talking about the sort of dueling roles here of politics and central banking. Let me focus on Brazil for a little bit, if we could. There, it seems like we've almost become inured to the political upheaval. How do you navigate an environment like that, where there still seems to be so much uncertainty politically? Is there opportunity to be found in Brazil today?
Well, I think yes, on your question on whether there are opportunities. And I think one has to be a bit more of a long-term player there. In Brazil, we've seen a significant decline in political noise compared to when President Dilma was impeached. Basically, now we have a caretaker government until the next presidential elections. And our base case scenario outside of a tail risk is that we see a centrist coalition party come back into power. This is incredibly important for them to actually push through on the pension and social security reform that they were trying to enact over the last couple of quarters. Where do I see value in Brazil? I think the local rate story there is still very compelling. The central bank governor is extremely credible, and he's done an excellent job of anchoring expectations. And even in terms of being long the currency, given the very high carry that you're earning, you're more or less sheltered against any periods of volatility that may come about because of politics.
I mean, just to give us an example, and Lupin, I don't know if you're up to speed on this piece, but I'm fascinated. This is in U.S. dollar terms, a Philippine 25-year bond yielding 3.7%, trading near par. It's 67 basis points over the full faith and credit U.S. Treasury.
Right.
Why would someone buy that, given the economics and politics of the Philippines? That's a decision you face every day. Is that something you own?
What we're seeing in the Asian credit complex is almost a circularity in terms of how funds and assets are put to work. So in the Asian credit complex, and this is not just Philippines, spreads are incredibly tight relative to their credit fundamentals. And part of the reason is Asian investors have a kind of regional home bias, if you want to call it that, in terms of wanting to be invested within their economies and within the Southeast Asian region as a whole. And that's really what's driving the complete spread tightening. What we do in our portfolios is be underweight those credits that we think are misvalued, recognizing that sometimes this misvaluation can continue for some time.
I thank Torsten Slok for the theme that we have throughout the show today. We talked about normalization of volatility, the potential for there to be more normalized volatility. Dovetail that with emerging markets, if you could, here. What optimism do you have that there will be a catalyst that brings a more normal sense of volatility here to emerging markets in the near to medium term?
I think that thinking about EM vol as an asset class is relatively misleading. I think the reason why we've seen low vol in both fixed income and in EM in particular has been to do with global factors and the Fed and the ECB in particular. As those retrench, I do expect volatility to increase. And in EM, it is going to be very, very country specific. And as we've talked before, it's related to politics, it's related to particular technicals, it's related to US policy in places like Mexico and in China. So I do think it's not going to be a normalized average vol pickup, but it really will be country specific.
This has been wonderful. Lupin Raman, don't be a stranger with PIMCO. Greatly, greatly appreciate. She is global head of sovereign credit for PIMCO. David, that was fascinating.
Yes.
It was like a window into how you pick up 300 basis points.
And we didn't talk about this, but you know, I'm sure that the recent meetings of the IMF and the World Bank are a great bedrock or platform to talk about all this. What did you learn from being there in D.C., talking to all of these central bank governors and finance ministers, many of whom were from emerging markets, about the health of EM right now?
It's a good question, and my answer is I called it the yeah, but meetings. And that everybody's more optimistic. I just gave a speech for our good friends at Cohn-Reznick, and I said, you know, it's the optimistic speech, yeah, but.
Yes.
And that permeates everything that we see here in the autumn of 2017 is there's no question things are better across the board. And then you have to measure your yeah buts. And, you know, everybody's got their own opinion on that. And that was just a great dissertation with Lupin on how finding those pockets of value is difficult.
Yeah. And certainly key takeaway from me there is that when you look at politics, when you look at central banking, neither is more important at this point.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.